Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're in the book of Exodus. We're going from chapter 27, we're starting in verse 20, through chapter 30, verse 10. Tzevet. This is, you shall command. So starting Exodus chapter 27, verse 20. Now you shall command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure olive oil, pressed for illumination, to kindle a lamp continually in the tent of meeting outside the partition that is near the testimonial tablets. Aaron and his sons shall arrange it from evening until morning before the Lord, an eternal decree for their generations from the children of Israel. Chapter 28. And you shall bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar, the sons of Aaron, to minister to me. You shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron, your brother, and for glory and splendor. You shall speak to all the wise-hearted people whom I have invested with the spirit of wisdom, and they shall make the vestments of Aaron to sanctify him to minister to me. These are the vestments they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic of box-like knit, a turban, and a sash. They shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron, your brother, and his sons, to minister to me. They shall take the gold and turquoise, purple and scarlet wool, and linen. They shall make the ephod of gold, turquoise, purple and scarlet wool, and twisted linen, a weaver's craft. It shall have two shoulder straps attached to its ends. It shall be attached. The belt with which it is emplaced, which is on it, shall be of the same workmanship. It shall be made of it of gold, turquoise, purple, scarlet wool, and twisted linen. You shall take the two Shoham stones and engrave upon the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on one stone and the names of six of the remaining on the other stone, according to the order of their birth. A jeweler's craft, like the engraving of a signet ring, shall you engrave the two stones with the names of the sons of Israel. Encircled with gold settings shall you make them. You shall place the stones on the shoulder straps of the ephod. These are remembrance stones for the sons of Israel. Aaron shall carry their names before the Lord on both his shoulders as remembrance. You shall make settings of gold and two chains of pure gold. Make them at the edges of braided craftsmanship, and place the braided chains on the settings. You shall make a breastplate of judgment, of woven design, like the craftsmanship of the ephod, shall you make it. Gold, turquoise, purple, scarlet wool, and linen, twisted together, shall you make it. Square shall it be, folded, its length half a cubit, its width half a cubit. You shall fill it with stone mounting, four rows of stone, a row of odem, pitad, barex, one row, the second row, nofech, sapir, yachalom, the third row, leshem, shevo, achlama, and the fourth row, tarshish, shoham, and yashve. Set each in gold shall they be in their moldings. The stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names, engraved like a signet ring. Each according to its name shall they be for the 12 tribes. For the breastplate you shall make chains at the edges, a braided craftsmanship of pure gold. For the breastplate you shall make two rings of gold, and you shall place the two rings on the gold ends, the two ends of the breastplate. You shall place two golden ropes on the two rings at the ends of the breastplate, and two ends of the two ropes you shall place on the two settings, which you shall place the shoulder straps of the ephod toward its front. You shall make two rings of gold and place them on the two ends of the breastplate at its bottom, on the inner side, toward the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and place them at the bottom of the two shoulder straps of the ephod toward its front, opposite the seam, above the belt of the ephod. They shall attach the breastplate from the rings to the rings of the ephod with turquoise woolen cord, so it will remain above the belt of the ephod, and the breastplate will not be loosened from the ephod. Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breastplate of judgment over his heart when he enters the sanctuary, as a constant remembrance before the Lord. Into the breastplate of judgment you shall place the Urim and the Tumim. And they shall be on Aaron's heart when he comes before the Lord, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel on his heart constantly before the Lord. You shall make the robe of the ephod entirely of turquoise wool. Its head opening shall be folded over within it. Its opening shall have a border all around of a weaver's work. It shall be for it like the opening of a coat of mail. It may not be torn. You shall make on its hem pomegranates of turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool, on its hem all around, and gold bells between them all around. A gold bell and a pomegranate, a gold bell and a pomegranate, all the hem around the robe. It will must be on Aaron in order to minister. Its sound shall be heard when he enters the sanctuary before the Lord and when he leaves, so that he will not die. You shall make a head plate of pure gold, and you shall engrave on it the engravement like a signet ring, holy to the Lord. You shall place it on a cord of turquoise wool. It shall be on the turban. Opposite to the front of the turban it shall be. It shall be on Aaron's forehead, so that Aaron shall bring forgiveness for a sin regarding the sacred offerings the children of Israel consecrate for any gifts of their sacred offerings. It shall be on his forehead always to bring them favor before the Lord. You shall also make a linen tunic of a box-like knit. You shall make a linen turban, so you shall make a sash of embroider's work. For the sons of Aaron, you shall make tunics and make them sashes, and you shall make them headdresses for glory and splendor. With them you shall dress Aaron your brother and his sons with him. You shall anoint them, inaugurating them and sanctify them, and they shall minister to me. You shall make them linen breeches to cover over the flesh of their nakedness. From the hips to the thighs shall they be. They shall be on Aaron and his sons when they enter the tent of meeting, or when they approach the altar to serve in holiness. They should not bear a sin and die. It is an eternal decree for him and his offspring after him. Chapter 29. This is the matter that you shall do for them to sanctify them to minister for me. Take one young bull and two rams, unblemished, with unleavened breads, unleavened loaf, mixed with oil, unleavened wafer, smeared with oil. Made of fine wheat flour, you shall make them. You shall place them in a single basket and bring them near in the basket, with the bull and the two rams. Aaron and his sons you shall bring near to the entrance of the tent of meeting. You shall immerse them in water. You shall take the vestments and dress Aaron with the tunic, the robe of the ephod itself, the breastplate, and you shall gird him with the belt of the ephod. You shall place the turban on his head and place the crown of sanctity over the turban. You shall take the anointing oil and pour it on his head and anoint him. You shall cause his sons to come near and dress them in tunics. You shall girdle them with a sash, Aaron and his sons, and you shall wrap the headdresses on them. The priesthood shall be an eternal duty for them. You shall inaugurate Aaron and his sons. You shall bring the bull near before the tent of meeting. Aaron and his sons shall lean their hands on the head of the bull. You shall slaughter the bull before the Lord, before the entrance of the tent of meeting. You shall take some of the blood of the bull and place it with your finger on the horns of the altar. He shall pour all the blood at the base of the altar. He shall take the fat that covers the innards, the diaphragm with the liver, the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them. He shall cause them to go up in smoke on the altar. The flesh of the bull, its hide, and its waste he shall burn in fire outside the camp. It is a sin offering. He shall take the first ram. Aaron and his sons shall lean their hands on the head of the ram. He shall slaughter the ram and take its blood and throw it on the altar all around. He shall cut the ram into pieces, wash the innards and its feet, and place them with its pieces and its head. And you shall cause the entire ram to go up in smoke upon the altar. It is a burnt offering to the Lord, a satisfying aroma, the fire offering to the Lord. You shall take the second ram. Aaron and his sons shall lean their hands on the second ram, and you shall slaughter the ram. You shall take some of its blood and place it on the middle part of the ear of Aaron, and on the middle part of the ear of his sons, the right one, and on the thumb of their right hand, and the big toe of their right foot. You shall throw the blood upon the altar all around. You shall take some of the blood that is on the altar and some of the anointing oil and sprinkle it on Aaron and on his vestments and on his sons and all the vestments of his sons with him. He and his vestments and the sons and the sons' vestments with him shall become holy. From the ram you shall take the fat, the tail, the fat that covers the innards, the diaphragm with the liver, the two kidneys, the fat is on them, the right thigh. It is a ram of perfection. One cake of bread, of the bread, the oily loaf, and the wafer, from the basket of unleavened loaves, that is before the Lord. You shall place it on the palms of Aaron and on the palms of his sons. You shall wave them as a waving before the Lord. You shall take them from their hands and cause to go up in smoke on the altar, on the burnt offering, as a satisfying aroma for the Lord. It is a fire offering to the Lord. You shall take the breast of the inauguration ram that is Aaron's, and you shall wave it as a wave offering before the Lord. Then it shall be your portion. You shall sanctify the breast of the waving and the thigh of the raising up that was waved and was raised up from the inauguration ram that was for Aaron and his sons. It shall be for Aaron and his sons as an eternal portion from the children of Israel. It is a portion. It shall remain a portion from the children of Israel from their peace offering gift, the feasts, their portion to the Lord. The holy vestments of Aaron shall belong to his sons after him to become elevated through them, to become inaugurated through them for a 7-day period. The Kohen who succeeds him from his sons, who shall enter the tent of meeting to serve the sanctuary, shall put them on. You shall take the inauguration ram and cook its flesh in a holy place. Aaron and his sons shall eat the flesh of the ram and the bread that is in the basket before the entrance of the tent of meeting. They who receive atonement through them to inaugurate them, to sanctify them, shall eat them. An alien shall not eat, for they are holy. If anything shall be left over from the flesh of the inauguration offering, or from the bread until the morning, you shall burn the leftover in fire. It may not be eaten, for it is holy. You shall do this for Aaron and his sons, like everything that I have commanded you. For 7 days you shall inaugurate them. A bull sin offering shall you make for each day of the atonements. You shall purify the altar by bringing atonement for it. You shall anoint it to sanctify it. For a 7-day period, you shall bring atonement to the altar and sanctify it. The altar shall be holy of holies. Whatever touches the altar shall become sanctified. This is what you shall offer upon the altar. 2 sheep in their first year, every day continually. You shall offer 1 sheep in the morning, and the 2nd sheep you shall offer in the afternoon. A tenth ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/4 hin of beaten oil, and a libation of 1/4 hin of wine for each sheep. You shall offer the 2nd sheep in the afternoon, like the meal offering in the morning, and its libation shall you offer it, for a satisfying aroma. A fire offering to the Lord as a continual burnt offering for your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord where I shall set my meeting with you to speak to you there. I shall set my meeting there with the children of Israel and it shall be sanctified with my glory. I shall sanctify the tent of meeting and the altar and Aaron and his sons I shall sanctify to minister to me. I shall rest my presence among the children of Israel. I shall be their God. They shall know that I am the Lord their God, who took them out of the land of Egypt, to rest my presence among them. I am the Lord their God. Chapter 30. You shall make an altar on which to bring incense up in smoke. Of acacia wood shall you make it. Its length a cubit, its width a cubit. It shall be square. Its height 2 cubits, from it shall its horns be. You shall cover it with pure gold. Its roof and its walls all around, and its horns, you shall make for it a gold crown all around. You shall make for it 2 gold rings under its crown on its 2 corners. You shall make on its 2 sides, it shall be for the housings of the staves, which to carry it. You shall make the staves of acacia wood and cover them with gold. You shall place it before the partition that is by the ark of the testimonial tablets. In front of the cover that is on the testimonial tablets, where I shall set my meetings with you. Upon it Aaron shall bring the spice incense up in smoke. Every morning when he cleans the lamps, he shall bring it up in smoke. And when Aaron kindles the lamps in the afternoon, he shall bring it up in smoke. Continual incense before the Lord for your generations. You shall not bring upon it alien incense, or a burnt offering or meal offering, nor may you pour a libation offering on it. Aaron shall bring atonement upon its horns once a year from the blood of the sin offering of atonements. Once a year. Shall you bring the atonement upon it for your generations? It is holy to the Lord. That was Exodus chapter 27 from roughly verse 20 through 30, verse 10. A lot of stuff about, you know, obviously Aaron and his clothing, details about the altar and such. Any questions, comments, things I can answer for you, or things you brought to your attention? Yes, Don.
Yes, they talk about wool and linen.
Yes.
Okay.
Wool and linen. As you will note, most of you are familiar with this, some of you may not be. In your Bibles, it is forbidden for you to wear wool mixed with linen. Please says, do not do so. However, the priests are explicitly commanded to do so. Why does God say don't mix wool and linen? And yet has a priest say you will have wool and linen? Simple reason. Mixing wool and linen is a priestly function and priestly aspect. It belongs to the priesthood, not the ordinary people. Mixing wool and linen, the linsey woolsey garments used to make in Civil War type days, that the soldiers make, that was not permitted for ordinary people. The linen and wool mixture is strictly for the priesthood's use. Hold on, he had his hand up first.
Did Aaron or Moses explain to the people what any of this stuff was for? The symbols of it?
sort of. Not in this section. They explain certain parts, certain details, and it's really complicated to try to figure out what their explanation is and how it applies to his clothing. I mean, honestly, do we care what somebody is dressed like? Well, God does, and we'll discuss what it means. But as far as the ordinary people, what they understood is probably limited. However, the prophets do cover what some of the stuff actually means and what the symbolisms are. But of course, the people, that's generations go by as they learn, understand, and learn more about it by watching. The best way to teach a child is by making them watch you do something. They see how it's done. They can ask questions after they've watched it and practice and start doing it. We all learn that way as little kids up until we're even now as older adults. We learn by watching someone do it and then mimic what they're doing. As years go by, we start asking questions. Why is it done this way? What if we did this? Is this a problem? And that's how we get understanding. But initially, first time anybody's ever seen it, just watch and do. We'll explain later. Good idea. Yes, Carmel.
Okay, so actually, you are forbidden to mix the threads. So the priesthood did not mix the threads. They wore linen garments with ram or wool.
That's not entirely true. They didn't weave the threads.
That's what I'm saying. They didn't weave it together.
A single garment had both linen and wool in the garment. Not as a weave, as a braid.
Where did you see that?
That's how the ephod is actually made. The ephod is, the description of the ephod is given here in the Torah. It's also given by the wonderful historian Josephus, who describes what it looked like because he was alive, he got to see it. He described the actual garments, the weaving of it, as we think of weaving like the woof and the warp of a weave, as opposed to a braid with inside. That's a different style of done, that's done differently. So the ephod is actually a braid of the linen wrapped with inside the wool as it goes around. It's done on purpose, but it's strictly for the priesthood to wear it that way. Not as a woof and warp, like we think of fabric, but as a woven braid style. Does that make sense? So they were allowed to braid it, not as a woof and warp style that we have fabric today.
I would like for you to, I'll have to, please give me those scriptures that describe it, because, we come into it all the time about
people
the woven,
ask about it a lot for the business
the
you guys
woven.
Are in. Yeah.
And what you're saying is a lot of people believe that the frequencies in both of them cancel each other out
right.
if they're next to each other.
Right.
And one of my, I've always tell people is, look, God dressed the temple, the tabernacle. He had linen curtains on the inside and covered it with ram skins. If they canceled each other out, or the frequency or the benefit canceled each other out, God wouldn't have dressed his temple in a way we can't dress our temples. But your argument here saying that the ephod was actually woven together,
right.
That proves they don't cancel each other out.
Right.
I would believe. If God did it, he's not going
to... I can speak to the frequency, the natural frequencies of linen versus wool. I know they have their own. Every fabric does. Everything
exactly
on planet
same.
Earth has a natural frequency to it.
Uh-huh.
I know that some have done the calculations and they measured and what they do to each other. Note, not all garments were done that way. It was strictly the ephod as well as the corded braids they would do. The tunics and the robes, they were distinctly their own fabric type. They didn't mix those. And you will note that, we'll discuss this, the tunic is the inner garment that covers somebody, like we think of underwear, and the robe is on the outer side. So, right, the items that were woven together, like the ephod, does not actually grab your skin. It's like an outer garment that wraps around you.
Right. Interesting. Okay, thank you. I'll look that up.
Okay. I know hands went up earlier. Yes, Deborah.
Okay, a question. Okay, and it says, Aaron's garments, the father will fill the person's mind, and he says, he has it with the wise hearted, he will fill them with his spirit. So I was wondering, is the spirit that something that comes in and out and goes in the person, or once they're filled with the spirit, is it there continuously? And this garment, this press, you know, in Exodus 28, is this this seed form grown in Ephesians 6:12? Where he's talking about the breastplate of righteousness and the shoes and the gospel of peace. Is this in Ephesians? Is this that garment that us are, well, the priests are supposed to have? And for us. And then, because, you know, he says, go out and make disciples. And so is this part of the garments we should be of trying to obtain?
Sorry, hold on a minute. I wrote that your second question. I prepped for your first question. I apologize. Your
spirit
question?
One, and then
the spirit. That's right. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, okay. And then Ephesians 6:12. Is that?
Yeah, I got the Ephesians one. Is the spirit
okay.
one? I
yeah, the spirit one.
Down.
Yeah, is the spirit something that
yeah.
comes in?
We'll
and
discuss
goes?
That.
Yeah,
hopefully, not quite yet. We'll soon.
Okay, because I know these clothes have.
They have their meanings.
Meaning.
Everything that God
right.
gives you is a symbol of something.
Absolutely.
Else.
And I know it's in the New Testament. I mean, it's in the Old Testament, and then it's developed
in
the New.
A lot of it's
in the
New Testament, too. Right.
Oh, yes.
We'll discuss
okay, thank
some. I will get to everything because we have Purim to today, too, but I'll get what I can. Others had their hands up, too. Who were they? Yes, go ahead.
So if we in the New Testament are called a kingdom of priests, right, then you were saying earlier about everybody shouldn't mix wool and linen.
Well, the commoners did not.
The commoners,
right.
But the priests did. So then if we're priests, then are we able
yeah.
to...
When and how is it done?
Okay.
So I could just randomly mix wool and linen together, but God has a specific method by which it's done for a reason. So an ordinary person coming along, or a priest in training, for example, would not just go up and grab, you know, the mixed garments and put them together and throw it together and say, hey, I'm going to go get dressed up for the day. It doesn't work that way. It's only specific ways for certain reasons at certain times it's done. The rest of the time it's not. They have their linen tunics they wore on their undergarments always, and in some cases they were also the same as the outer garment. And the high priest would wear his blue one on the outside when on particular one day a year, always, when he goes into for the Day of Atonement. So they had their garments they wore at certain times. The ephod was worn at certain times for certain tasks, and at other times it was taken off and set aside because you don't want to get it messy or dirty. So each thing has its purpose. That's why it's done. So if you have a kingdom of a priest or a priestly kingdom, the individual people, you have instructions on how something's done. You do the way it's instructed. As opposed to on our own choices, well, it's fine to mix it. No, it's not. Because if you do it in a common form, you are no longer acting as a priest. You're now a commoner. Make sense? The Aaron and his family, they were not to wear their tunics and their outfits on ordinary days. They weren't serving. You do it when you're serving. When you're not serving, you take them off and set them aside. Because they have their function. And you know, if you do a service and you don't put them on, your service is invalid. You did it wrong. If you put them on and don't do a service to something unrelated, you now made the garment common. It's not acceptable either. So both work together. The purpose behind it, what you're doing, as well as how you do it, matters. As opposed to just doing one or the other, it's mixed together. What you do and how you do it. Make sense? Right. Now, it does apply. It's applied because we know what most of these symbols actually are, like spiritual symbols mean, what the meaning is behind them. They apply. Not in the physical form, but the spirit behind them apply. And the spirit behind them is where these symbols come from, which God's instructing us about them. So we would place it in the spiritual aspect of each one of these tasks. If your spirit is in a mindset of whatever, and not focus on what God instructed you to do, is your instruction, whatever you're doing, is it valid? Well, let's pretend you're praying. And your mind's wandering off and thinking of your golf game. But keep saying the prayer, but your mind's wandering. Is God listening to your prayer? Of course not. He probably wants to find out how low your score is going to be because he's going to mess up your golf game later on. But the point is, you took your mindset out. You removed your mind from what you were doing. So again, the mind was wrong place. So then your prayer is worthless. So each aspect has its purpose, the spiritual behind the physical. So we'll discuss what most, I won't tell you all of them, but most of these things mean, the colors and the materials. Other questions there. We'll go for Deborah first. Go ahead.
Okay, so in the Bible, it always refers the Passover of the Jews. He always is making reference to the Jews. Yeah, is it in the New Testament?
Right.
Yeah, and I wondered if that, since Passover is coming up, but he keeps saying, you know, the Jews. I'm going up to the Feast of the Jews. And so I wanted to see if you could expound on that.
Okay, that particular phrase is used multiple times. Most of the book of John, I think, uses it more often than not. The Jews, no offense to anybody who disagrees. This is my personal opinion. The phrase "term to the Jews" is not a derogatory term. It's not a negative term. It's nothing evil about it. No, it's nothing evil about it. It's as opposed to the feast of anybody else. The feast of Gentiles, note when John was speaking this, who ruled his country? The Gentiles did. They ruled everything. No, they have their own feast days. Now, the Gentiles did. Of their pagan this and that god and this god and every other worshipful god you can think of. So that's all during John's time while he's writing this stuff down. And by the way, most argue he's probably the first one who actually recorded what was happening as opposed to everybody else wrote it later. He was recording what was going on. It's nothing wrong with the term Feast of Jews as opposed to Feast of the Gentiles or Feast of the Romans or Feast of the Greeks. Each has their own feast. Keep in mind that we look at the feast and say, okay, well, they're basically seven, you know, dominant feasts. Wait, that's only in our Bibles. Look at the pantheon number of feasts that the gods of Greeks have every single month. There's one almost every other day. There's some feast going on, some activity, some descendant of Titan, of God, of this, of the goddess, of whatever, did whatever thing umpteen billion years ago, and let's worship that thing. every single day. The Greeks ruled everything. So, the Romans. So they ruled it all. You have to distinguish it. Is it, which feast are we attending? Is the feast of Jews or feast of somebody else's? So it's not a derogatory term at all. It's not a negative term. It's an identification term. Because it could be some other random feast. And Josephus actually lists a number of them during his lifetime. He lived a few years after Messiah died. A whole bunch of them going on during his life. Say, well, they had this one, and this one, this one, that one, this one, this one. And we did this and this, they ignored those and those. He's discussing the details of what's going on as life. It's more of a political statement, feast of Jews, because you're identifying the politics between who's in charge of what. Sorry, Anne.
I'm in chapter... Chapter 30. Okay, 30. So I didn't realize that there's actually two altars. Okay, the altar that burns the ram or the...
Yes.
And then there's the altar that is the incense burning, which is, I think, maybe I'm wrong, the mercy seat itself.
Not quite.
Not, okay.
I'll draw...
All right, but the question is, the only time... The most holy altar, we'll call it, the most holy altar gets right. The blood on it, is at Passover with the atonement.
Yes, yes.
And only on the horns.
Correct.
And now I keep thinking of horns like, you know, the big old horn coming out, and it's not really that. It's something else.
It's corners.
The corners.
The corners.
Okay. So I was, I don't know why I was surprised about that, but... It's like, I'm thinking the altar is where the big animal goes. No, but that's outside the Holy of Holies.
Correct. There are two. You're absolutely right. It's a good observation. This describes there are two distinct altars. They have their own function. One is a gold one, and one's basically a brass or copper style one. The copper one can endure the heat. You put the, it's really big. You can put a cow on it and burn it all up.
Oh, thank you.
You put a cow on it and burn it all up. That's the one that endures the heat, has the fire in it, it's nice and hot. The gold one is very small. It is designed for incense only. And of course, the ones here, they put the blood on the four corners of it for atonement. That's its function. It has its own task, its own job. We're going to discuss that altar quite a bit today, if we can, if we get to it all. Because it is the most important one in the temple. Is that one. The animals, you can literally just say, set aside, it's not important. That one is the focus of what we're going to talk about today and why it's here, why God focuses on it very heavily in your book of Revelations, which we'll hopefully get to today, yes. Yes. Oh, hey, look, a nice pretty picture. That's the animal one. There's the bat. Now, this is there's the outer section here. Stop jiggling it. Give myself a headache. Thank you. You have the showbread table, which is here, the menorah, which is here, and this is the gold altar that you're just referring to, the extra one. This is one the incense goes on. Of course, our mercy seat is inside behind this partition curtain, which they did a little cutaway here to show the mercy seat would be. So that's approximately where it would be. Now, granted, orientation is artist's license, but still, that's basically how it would generalized look like. So they have two altars. This is the bronze where the animals go. Here's the wash basins, clean your body up. And this is the one which they do the incense on. We'll discuss the incense one and the menorah, which they are purposefully tied together here in the chapter 30 of Exodus. They're tied together because God wanted them tied together. They are intertwined with each other. We'll discuss that too. Yes, Rose.
The prayer times of the incense in morning and evening. We today, should we be praying at 9 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon? I mean...
You decide what you want to do. I'm not going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. That's your business.
I pray all the time. I don't have a specific hour.
A lot of people do. A lot of people do specific hours or do whatever, something at 9 and at 3 at their own local times. It's your decision what you want to do. People like, for example, Daniel, who prayed multiple times a day, he was on a set schedule. Everybody knew his exact time. So that's why they all said, hey, let's go check out. And we'll bring the curtain back. Hey, look what it did. Because they all knew he was going to be praying at that time because he always prays at certain times of day. And his prayer time was, since he faced the temple doing it, or Israel, Jerusalem in general, would have matched, since everybody had his time to the same thing, the times when the sacrifices were done. So he'd done it a morning and an evening at 9 o'clock, or sorry, 9 o'clock in the morning, give or take, 2 o'clock to noon, give or take, depends on your time, sunset, Sundays. That's what his time schedule would have been. Now, there are also other offerings done at different times of the day as well. For example, the incense offering is done earlier than the offering on the sheep the every day at 9 o'clock. The incense offering is done first thing in the morning. It's also the last thing in the evening or near toward the evening as well. So you actually have technically four services every single day at the temple. There's the two sheep that happen in the morning and the evening. There's also the incense offering also happens morning and evening. So there's four of them every day. So depending on what schedule you want to run by, that's your business. but they did exist and they were done on purpose. And our Bible is full of them because they reuses those times and those events over and over again to teach us things. Yes, come on.
Just for Rose, I try to read my Psalms at 9 and 3 and try to remember to do that. I have a system that I use. But there's a whole group of people I know joined Hashem, which is Mike Clayton's group out of North Carolina, and then the Ben Yosai or Benai Yosef. A bunch of them all do the Shema. And I've started doing that because there's times, like I have my alarm on my clock set, and if I have to pause it twice because I can't, you know, go get my Tehillim right then and do it, I've started just saying the Shema instead, and then I'll try and get to my Psalms later. But it at least, it gives me that opportunity to connect with him and say, yes, I acknowledge this 9 o'clock hour, and yes, Shema Israel. And Mike does it. I don't know if any of you ever watch Mike Clayton, but he stops in the middle of his broadcast. He stops no matter where he's at, what he's doing, driving, anything. They stop and they do the Shema. It takes 2 seconds. And it really, I don't know how to say this, but you know what? It really touches your heart. It really, it does something. And it started for me when I started reading my Psalms that way. But it really does, I don't know how to explain it, but there's a connection there that just doing it or saying it, and I pray all the time. I talk to God all the time. Him and I are like this. I'm just letting you guys all know. Me and God like this, okay?
Sure.
We talk. I talk in the car. I talk in the shower. I sing to him, you know? So all of that, and I do that all the time. But this specifically, I feel I'm acknowledging him at the time he said he wanted. And so just singing the Shema, it takes 2 minutes. No matter what I'm doing, I can stop and do it. And as soon as that alarm goes off, and it really does bless, it has blessed my life. That's all I can say.
It's a good blessing. Any other comments? Question before I jump into my little spiel here. All right, I'm trying to make this reasonably understandable and fast, but not too fast, so not lose anybody. We'll change colors. I like this color, though it's hard to erase. So, you shall command. All right. I should do a better drawing than that. Come on. So we have a menorah here. And the instructions are starting out. We have little oil, little flaming lamps to show up here. We're all doing a brief circle. I'm not going to argue right now discussing the shape of it. We discussed it. Jeff brought up last week. Menorah has been shaped lots of different ways, but we won't discuss the shape so much today. That was previous time. The oil for it. What is the oil? Where does it come from? Olive oil. Who brings it?
People.
The people. Do the priests bring it? No. The people do it. People. Ordinary people? Yes. Ordinary people like you and me. The rest of us. It's ours to bring the oil. The people. It's important that people do it, not the priests. Why is that? Anybody remember why? All right, I'll tell you why. I'll change colors to this one. It's green for olive.
Tammy knows.
I'm sure she does. And we'll put one on this side. My little olive branches. They look like Brussels sprouts, I know. I'm not the world's best artist, so my Brussels sprouts / olive branches. They have, olive oil comes out of them. Olive oil is used for a particular purpose. It is designed for light, but it has to be a particular job of light. What does a candle look like? Those of you who've seen candles, what do they look like? What's the extra flame look like? Looks like olive, well, like an upside or sideways eyeball. From a person's eye, it's about what it looks like, looking sideways. There's a reason why I said that way, because God says, these are my eyes. Every single one of them. My eyeballs. They're eyeballs. God's eyeballs. That's recorded in Zechariah. And he says, my eyes are the seven angels of God. So what's God doing? He's saying, these seven angels, my seven eyeballs, are supplied with the oil from my people. What does that mean? What are my seven eyeballs looking at? The people who supplied me with the oil. It's saying, God, here, look at me. Anybody ever pray to God? Do you want God to look at you or watch you while you're praying? Yes. That's what you're doing. You're asking God's eyes to look at you. That's the olive oil that comes. The people must supply it. Not the priesthood. It is for the people. This is an important aspect. It explains what we're going to talk about with that incense altar, why this menorah and that incense altar are tied together on purpose. God wanted them tied together. He explains everything about them, which is beautiful. And he does it all in the book of Revelations, but we'll get there when we get there. So in Zechariah chapter 4, it discusses the menorah and its functionality. It says there are two olive branches that come and feed the menorah. In Zechariah, of course, the seven eyes of God are watching. He explains in Zechariah 4 what they're for. These two olive branches, of course, are the witnesses or my testimony, the people who are speaking my words. So all this stuff, these two olive branches come, they feed the bottom, which, of course, feeds all the eyes. They are speaking their words. And these witnesses are supposed to witness. What do the witnesses witness about? Testimony of God, and who are they talking to? Yeah, the people, the ordinary people, telling them who God is. Guess what? God's this. God's doing this. You do this. Live their life this way. That's their job. So testimony, the individual people who are supposed to be being watched, are supplying the oil, supplying the eyes to God, so to speak. And these testimonial witnesses are supposed to feed what they supply to God and say, God, look at all these people. See them? Look at them. Raise them up. See them. That's what God's job is. To look and watch. So that's what the menorah is job. That's why it does it. We have a little seven candle menorah and we have our prayers there. The idea, the symbols behind it is that we have God watching us, seeing what we're doing and saying, well, hopefully, he's pleased. It's not a bad report, it's a good one. So that's their job of these items. So we have olive oil, must be supplied by the people, not the priesthood. The people, the ones, have to be watched. We want God to see what we're doing, right? Unless we're doing anything wrong. If we're doing wrong, what do we want? God, shine a light where my wrongness is so I can clean it up. Get rid of the shadows. Make sure my shadows, my dark places get light as well and the darkness goes away. We always want God to be watching us. So we supply him with the oil and he watches us. Is he really in need of oil because he's hungry? No. He can see you anyway. The point is, it's a symbol behind what his job is. He's not watching just one person or one group of people. He's got seven eyes. They watch. We use the seven churches, the seven angels of the seven churches. He's watching everybody, who is desiring or trying to be called by his name. Because they're the ones who are offering up their prayers, aren't they? People who believe in God, what do? You pray, right? I do. Most of us do. People don't believe in God, they pray? Not often. They don't believe in a God, there's no reason to pray. If there's no reason to pray, nothing to lift up to God. Nothing for God to see. So does God want to see them? Not really. They're kind of messy. A little dirty. They'd be cleaned up. We'll work on that later. But that's the job of these seven eyes. So, the people have to do it. Now, what I want to point out to you, this is my little pet peeve. Oh, who would hand up? No. Oh, yes, go ahead.
The oil is fuel, though.
It is fuel. It's fuel from the people bringing up to God so God will see them.
Right. So, but the fuel is...
The olive oil, it's olive oil itself, the fuel, the symbolism behind the fuel. Lots of opinions on this.
We keep our oil burning.
Yeah, keep your oil burning. Keep your light burning. Lots of opinions on this one. A lot of people argue that the oil represents your faith. And these are, no, it doesn't. that's not oil's job. Oil's job is represent what you see or what you are at your appearance. Water represents your faith or your spirit. That's a different term. But that's its. The idea is to describe this more simply. Let's pretend for a minute we understand. Let's pretend you're all oil manufacturers. You make olive oil. What do? First of all, you have to have trees, right? With little olives on it. What do you have to do with olives? You have to pick them and crush them. What is that called? What, say it louder.
Pressing.
Is that done by itself? Who does it? The baker. What is that maker then? Wait, let's pretend I have an olive grove. I've got, you know, people working for me. Lots and lots of them all over the place. I have lots of money. Let's pretend. It's stretch your imagination a bit. So we have all these people. They're gathering this money. They're crushing it. They're called workers, aren't they? They actually work. It's a task you do, right? So working, this pressing, they must make it, makes you pure, which means you have to clean it or filter it out. It's all work. So I have a question for you. Your people's work is, what's the product of your work? In this case, it's olive oil. So what are you lifting up to God to see? Your work, what you do. So when we lift up to God, say, God, look at this part of my life, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, I don't care. What are you trying to get him to do? Either see what good things you've done, my work, I've cleaned up this, I stopped doing that, whatever, or help me work at whatever I'm doing wrong and fix this or that or whatever. It's always based on what you're doing. So that's why it's a pressed, cleaned olive oil by the people. They actually have to do something, make it, and then bring it to God, and God says, yes, you've made this, now I will look at what you've made. That makes sense? That's a little behind their theory, or behind the point of it. So your olive oil, which you make, is a work aspect, and God's supposed to look at what do you produce? Is it for God, or is it for someone else? Yes.
So then that would answer the mystery of what is the oil in the virgin's lamps?
Good job. Yes. Correct. That answer. Because that's what it is. That's exactly what he explains it to be, what its function is, and how the people are doing it. It's all about what do you do? And did I do well? Did I do poorly? Is my work worthy to you, God, or is it worthless to you, God? That's the whole point behind it. Makes sense? That's the functionality of the olive oil and how it works the lamps. Let's move a little further forward. Okay. Now, as you notice in this section, it starts out with the olive oil, then it goes straight into this massive description of his garments, the clothing that Aaron wears, the pretty blue robe, and it's actually like a sky blue, an azure type of blue, or a turquoise blue. And of course, there's obviously the multicolors, the purples, the reds, the pomegranates, the golds, all the stuff as far as how it's outfitted. That's done independent of this, because there's a reason why God broke it up this particular way. Oh, do you have a picture of that too? Oh, score. Look at that. You're just all organized. Make me look bad. So, in this blue, well, okay, I may disagree on how it was designed, but that's okay. Again, artist interpretation. In this particular outfit, it's a similar nature of what, you know, some would argue is pretty close to it. I don't know about this whole cantor burning thing, but you have the belt, the ephod itself is supposed to be outside. They've drawn this up fairly large. That's this blue and gold and patterned outfit. That's like an overcoat, we would think of it. Technically, it's a little bit longer. It comes down a bit, you know, roughly around mid-calf is where the ephod would usually end, but that's okay. And it doesn't have a little space right here underneath the breastplate. The breastplate itself is a little target right there. The target, a bunch of stones on it. Those targets, of course, it's approximate size. It's square. It's folded. The breastplate has a fold in it, so it's shaped. The fabric, if I was looking at the side, well, so it's side cover. Yeah, no kidding. It's a fold back here. I'm going to draw a basic fold. You have rings on the top, which goes to the top of it. There's also, as it shows down here, designed to catch the ephod belt below and the shoulder straps up top, so grabs all four spots. Inside this fold, in this little area here, is the Urim and Thummim. What do those two words mean? Anybody remember? Urim and Thummim. Do you remember what it meant? What's the words? What does Urim mean?
Light.
Or lights. It's Urim is plural, so it's lights. What does two mean? The louder? Truth. Or truths, plural. It's what is true versus what is not true. Anybody have any idea what those look like? Just answer no. Good. Do we know how those two worked? Answer no. There's lots of ideas on how they worked, and there's examples on what they did with them throughout your Bible. But how they worked, no one really knows. And what they look like, no one really knows. I will tell you, however, what they did. So one was this, well, I don't know. Could have been. most have argued that it was either two rocks or two hollow objects. Not sure which one it is, or maybe one of each. One's a hollow object, one's a rock. I don't really know. One produced light and one produced letters. So the functionality of it, essentially, this is not, you know, necessarily what they look like. I'm just drawing up an example. So I've got two objects. Doesn't matter what they look like, they're just there. One produces light, one produces truth. The functionality of these, the only examples given throughout your Bible, is when the priest, the high priest, mind you, this is not a prophet, rather just the high priest, when the high priest has to go to God and ask a question. That's different than when prophets go to God and ask questions. When prophets go to God and ask questions, what do they receive? Visions, dreams, and rare occasions, actually a verbal answer. Not too often. When priests go to God, they don't get visions, they don't get dreams. What do they get? Counsel, written answers. That sounds great. Who would want God to write you a letter? That'd be great. Well, not quite so easy. How many letters in the Hebrew alphabet? Yeah, in different forms he did in the Bible. Lots of letters. So I forgot the number actually. 22, something like that. Plus the ending letter. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So a lot of letters. So I'll just bring a few down here. Here's a Shem, an Aleph, a Lamed, and let's do a Kaf, and a Hey, and a Tet. A lot of letters, right? The way in which they're supposedly worked, I can't say it's true or not, but it's how the belief is, that when you ask God a question, certain letters would light up. And the priest would then have to interpret what those letters mean. It could be 5 letters, it could be 20 letters. The priest got to figure out what the order they come in. It's not quite so simple to God's answer, because they're not necessarily done in order. So that's where the light and the truth, or what is true, what God went to. When the priests go and they ask God, for example, this example in the attacking the tribe of Benjamin, they ask God, which tribe should go first against Benjamin, this book of Judges? And God says, Judah will go first. Well, how did the priest find that out? Well, it says the priest has the ephod with him, which means he has a breastplate with him, which means he has the Urim and Thummim with him. So the priest asks, that means somehow these things or gave him an answer identifying that Judah went first. So he interpreted Judah went first. This is a critique, a criticism obviously given to these two items because they're not very good at using, you know, getting complete answers. Because you can spell Hebrew words a lot of different ways. You can rearrange letters and mean opposite things. And the citation is, of course, Eli. Remember the priest Eli? Remember what happened to him? He has two sons, Hophni and I forgot the other guy. They're both dead. Anyway, Eli doesn't reprimand his sons for sleeping with the girls that came in the temple and harassing them, and he wouldn't do anything about it. So God whacks him and all his sons. But in that storyline, Eli runs across Hannah, the mother of Samuel. During his lifetime, of course, Samuel, of course, raises up, becomes the priest later on. But in that story, Eli accuses her of being drunk because her lips are moving. He can't understand what she's saying, can't see her very well. Whatever reason, he thinks her lips are moving. The theory is, which I think is wrong, but they think it anyway, is that the Urim, the word for drunk woman and righteous woman is the exact same word, but two letters flipped around. So if you see the letters and say, I will arrange it this way, you're a drunk woman. If I swap two letters around, it means you're a righteous woman. Don't know if he used them or not. Who knows? It doesn't make a difference. The point is, it's risky when you use something like this method to determine what God's trying to tell you. Because you as a man have to figure out with God's spirit what order the letters go in. Not very accurate. Not very reliable. I wouldn't trust it. But it was there. The point of it, why was it there? That's what matters. Yes?
That's what I was going to ask.
Oh, you're asking? Why were they there?
This was mandated by the scriptures about how to
make the ephod, right?
Yes, it's part of the, this is actually part of the breastplate itself. It goes inside the breastplate. So it's a breastplate, it's a folded, pretend this is two pieces of fabric, or it's one piece of fabric. It was like this piece of fabric, and they folded it like that. So, well, this isn't square, but we pretend that was square. So there was double one side, they folded up. And so inside, they would shove these two items.
Like a pouch.
Like a pouch, yes, like a kangaroo pouch kind of thing. Why was it there? That's what matters. Let's discuss why it's there. So why would light and truth be there? It says, well, let's explain, it says quite plainly why it's there. This is in verse, let's see here. Was it 15? Get back to my scriptures here. Hold on a minute. There it is. Okay. So it says, we'll jump to, 30, yeah, verse 38. Into the breastplate of judgment shall you place, oh, sorry, chapter 28, verse 30. At breastplate you shall place the Urim and Thummim. They shall be on Aaron's heart. When he comes before the Lord, Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel on his heart constantly before the Lord. What's the function then of these two things? The judgment, he's bearing the judgment of Israel on his heart for the Lord. So what is light and truth? Judgment of Israel. It's a judgment of Israel. That's its function. It's a symbol. It's a judgment of Israel that you're actually carrying on your heart. May it be good. That is their functionality. That's why it's hidden behind all the stones representing each of the tribes that are tucked in that actually covered it. This is their inner being. The inner being of the people is a representation of these. Their judgments and their light, what they see, what they understand, that's tucked in. That's what's presented before God. And they are being shielded or wrapped around by this breastplate, supposed to cover it. That's its purpose. That's why it's there. To find out Israel, I mean the people's, light and truth. What is true to you and what is light? Do you want to darken the dark? Do you want light to shine in your dark places? Or do you not want light to shine in your dark places? Do you want truth to come true? Or do you not want truth to come through? Go ahead, say it loud.
So then, if they're inside, tucked behind,
yes,
the 12 tribes of Israel,
then obviously the lights and the truth is what is representative of the judgments of the people. But is it also that the people are to guard the light and the truth?
That's Aaron's job.
Right.
Yes.
So he gave his truth and his light to these people to
hold on
it,
to it, to be
to
inside
it.
Them,
yes.
As inside of you.
Yes. Okay.
That's why these stones are in front, and behind them is what, it's like, if I can't see inside of you, where your heart's supposed to be, I can't see that. I can only see what's in front, what you look like. Well, the whole point of having these tucked behind, it's covering Aaron's heart. It's also be inside, used sort of loosely inside, not physically inside, but they're pretending to be, inside the people where light and truth is supposed to dwell. So darkness is not in you, but rather light and truth is in you at all times. Make sense? That's how you make proper judgments, isn't it? I can't make a good judgment if I only have darkness and lies in me. I make false judgments. If I make good judgment, I must have light and judgment or truth in me to make good judgments. That's why it's called the breastplate of judgment, to judge rightly. Yes.
Those two things that you're speaking of, were they stones or pieces of cloth or?
Sure.
What were they?
I don't know.
But what you're saying is those two things were the Urim and the Thummim.
Yes. I don't know what they actually look like. It doesn't say whether they're made from rocks. It doesn't say they're made from metal or made from fabric. We don't know. It doesn't describe what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a question for you. There's a reason why it isn't explained. What does light look like?
Bright.
It's bright. What does truth look like? It's just true. See, there's a reason why it's not explained what they look like, because who cares what they look like? Light is light and truth is truth. It doesn't have an appearance, it has a state of being. It just exists. That's why the description wasn't given as far as how to make them or what they look like. Because it doesn't matter what light looks like, it's just light. It doesn't matter what truth looks like, it's just true. That's what's supposed to be inside of you. Who cares what the appearance looks like? It is either light and truth, or it is darkness and lies. Those don't have an appearance of an object. They have a concept of what their function is. That's why it doesn't have a description as to what it looks like. Yes?
Well, it's just funny because it's almost like light is a function of truth. You know, like we have that saying, you know, the truth sheds light on situations.
Right.
You know, it dispels the darkness automatically.
That's, they're always together. you can't separate them. You can't divide them out. Yes.
Well, we were just recently in our family, we had to make a judgment about what light and what truth looked like, because it does eventually end up coming out as a judgment, which then takes a manifestation in a physical form.
Exactly.
So
that's why all these stones have their color, have their setting, have their shape, has a particular way, because when the inside has light and truth, it will shine out and make a form on the outside, which everyone will see. That it has its function. The items themselves don't have appearance. What they affect, the breastplate, is the appearance, how the outward manifests themselves in our lives, in our being. That's how light and truth show up. No one knows you have light and truth in you until you do something or demonstrate it somehow, whether how you conduct yourself or how you make a righteous judgment, whatever it may be. You have to demonstrate it in your life. That demonstrates you have light and truth in you. Otherwise, no one knows. Does that make sense? That's perfect. Okay. Any questions, comments so far? Yes, Jeff.
So what you're saying is that we need to purge out the malice and wickedness so that we can bring in transparency and truth? Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, malice, but is, what is it? What's that card game? Spite and malice. Yeah. Get rid of both those things, right? Get rid of those things to show what is good and right. And of course, this breastplate, what does the priest wind up doing with it? He's going and walking around so God sees him all the time. So what do you want if you're supposed to, this represents you, by the way, tribes of Israel. What do you want? For God to see your outward appearance that demonstrates you have light and truth inside of you. Your judgments are true and right. Does that make sense? That's its symbolic function. So, do we wear those things as high priests? Not the high priest, as a priest. Yeah, you have to. Not that we have to care whether it's a mix of this color or that stone or this fabric or that fabric. It's what is inside me and what am I presenting to God? So we spiritually do exactly what the high priest is doing. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move forward, because there's more stuff than that. Okay, I jumped out of order. I apologize. I was supposed to go to the shoulder piece, the ephod first, which I kind of talked about briefly. In the ephod, that little pointer thing would be helpful. The ephod is the outer garment with a belt. It has two stones on the top of the shoulders, which the breastplate has its chains that go over and attach to it. Those stones have the names of Israel written in the birth order, six on each side. They are, people argue what they look like. The most realized, they're basically a green emerald type color stone. So it's basically an emerald type stone is on those two shoulders. They all have their engraved, you have a, oh, how's that little button work? Score. So it has little chains attached to it from both sides. Of course, it has little stones on both ends. Why would God want these things on the high priest's shoulders? Carry the burden. What burden is he carrying? Yeah, the people. Holy cow, that's a serious burden. It's everything. So what's on his shoulders at all times? The names, I'm going to erase this because I don't need any more. I erase part of this because it's not important. So on his shoulders at all times, he always has the names of Israel on him. In their birth order. Why does birth order matter? Any guess? See, the nature of the birth order was Reuben was born first and went through its order. But Reuben lost his birthright. And it bypassed him and had to go to Joseph because the next firstborn, it all went out of order. So the birth order is what is considered true is always on his shoulders, what the responsibility is. So on his birth order, it's supposed to be in a certain order. I don't remember all the order, forgive me, but Reuben was number one. I gotta spell that wrong.
You're E-U-U-E.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm kidding. He lost it. Why did he lose it? What did he do? Slept with his father's wife. I forgot what her name was. He slept with her. So he lost it. It says it over and over and over again, by the way. Your Bible repeats it, why he lost it. Because then once you realize, that's a bad thing. So he doesn't get that. And it went to Joseph.
Joseph. PH. Thank you.
I found an E in there somewhere. Joseph gets it instead. He wasn't the first, he wasn't even second. Well, he was the firstborn of Rachel, therefore being the firstborn. Well, what about the other concubines? They had firstborns, yet they were not given to wives, as in, yes, I want to marry him. They would say, here, assistant, here's your job. Go do your job, slave woman, essentially. It's not really a choice in that matter. It's that you are given to the job. So there are only two true wives, which was Leah and Rachel. True wives. The rest of them were secondary concubine-style wives. So Joseph gets the what was that? Yes, they're true credit to, but their firstborns don't apply. So Joseph was firstborn for Rachel. So all the presents went from Reuben to Joseph. This is a mess up, isn't it? It's out of order, right? It should be out of order, because Reuben should get first. That means Reuben gets double. Well, he messed it up. When you're bearing their names on your shoulders, what are you carrying then? All their screw-ups, too. It's to remind everybody who sees the high priest with this ephod on that, yes, there is a birth order. There was a way it was supposed to go. And we know how it actually went. It's a reminder to always remember what is supposed to happen versus what actually did happen. To never, ever forget. Yes.
Which was, what were the names on the stones? And which?
Oh, crud.
Was it Manasseh, Joseph, or Joseph?
He's on the, Joseph would be on there. Okay. Levi would be on there. They would not have broken up Ephraim and Manasseh. They would have combined it together to Joseph. So Joseph would be there. The birth order. I don't remember the birth order. I'm sorry. It's written in Genesis. It's the order, the first six from one and the second six. I forgot which one was born when. No, he stays in the order he was born. He always stays the first because he was supposed to be firstborn. So he still gets there. I'm not sure which is right and left, which they put the right hand and left hand side. But he still gets the order which they're born in, regardless of their birth, regardless of what their benefit was. Because their birth order is one way, their birthright got lost. Yes?
Okay, so you got birth order on the top. What was the order on the breastplate? Was that birth order too?
It doesn't say. I don't know. It doesn't say. I can guess most likely, but I don't know. Because just the nature of what God was doing with the birth order on the shoulders, he probably had the birth order of the stones. Though he rattled off what the stones were. He lists them all off their names. Well, how would anybody know which stone corresponds to which son? It's not written anywhere. Well, they have to know. So the people who were sitting there gathering these stones, they knew which stone represented which tribe. They didn't write it down for us to read, but they knew it. So anybody who watched him or saw him would have known what the order was. But of course, they didn't write it down. I think probably it was also birth order. Probably. But I can't swear to it. Yes, David. He's getting extra today.
So I just wanted to, say that, it's the same when Yeshua was talking about the yoke.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
It's on his shoulder. It's yes. The burden. And he's reflecting it to the same.
That's exactly what it means. That's precisely what it is. It's Yeshua's explanation of my yoke. That's what it is. What's he carrying? The entire tribe of Israel on his shoulder. That's what it means. He is the one carrying it. It's all their burdens he's carrying too. He says, what's my yoke is light. Yours is heavy. Not a problem. I can carry their burdens. It's not an issue because he's infinitely strong. He can carry the burdens. It's not a big deal. But it's supposed to carry the burdens of the children of Israel. So remember, that's what it means. He is thy priest. This is his yoke. It's literally attached that way. It's made to look that way.
So Yeshua has that role now.
Yes, Yeshua is our high priest. So he has this functionality. That's why we're going through the symbolism here. So that's what Messiah is doing at all times he goes before God. Any prayer you have, guess what Messiah looks like? That. In God's eyes, meaning not like he actually has an outfit on. My point is, the symbols behind what each of these things represent is what he's presenting before God for every prayer you give in his name, of course. Yes.
I'm sorry, but it's just, as Lisa whispered in my ear, it really set it home. The fact that when he puts that on and that plate of gold, which we know gold is one of the heaviest metals, he puts that on, instantly he's feeling that weight, and he understands the burden that he's taken on in that role, and rightfully stands up straight, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he carries it all for one for a particular day. You're right. It is designed, the entire output's put on one day a year. It is designed, well, actually, one day of a year, but then also for 7 days when he gets inaugurated. So he actually wears a little more time than that. The first guy. He has to, you know, build up his muscles initially. So he wears it the first 7 days, but then from that point on, it's one day a year. He presents all this stuff before God at atonement. Remember, what is the purpose of a day of atonement? To take all the sins you did, put them in a nice little ball, set them on the goat, and say, go away. That's its function of atonement. So in this presentation, what's God seeing when he sees the high priest and he has this big old outfit get up on? He's before God. He's presenting all the sins we already said, God, go away. Here's what we look like now. Yes, Jeff.
It just reminded me of Isaiah 9:6 when it's foretelling of the Messiah. For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given, and the government shall be on his shoulders. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Amen.
Amen. Yeah, government on his shoulders. That's a lot of work. You can just, you know, go to our local politician and ask them. Let's move forward a little bit. So we have ephod. Most of this outfit contains these dominant same colors, other than the stones themselves. You have gold, you have blue, you have purple, and you have red. The different tones of blue, it's dominantly a sky type of blue or a lighter blue. The red is usually a deeper red, and of course the purples are a mix of them. And remember what those colors mean? Or you've probably forgotten it, because we don't discuss it very often. Good question. Where did we learn it? Where is that learned at? Oh, that's right. This is how we learned it. We look up. So, wrong color. Wrong color. Because blue is up. When you think of the heavenly bodies, you think of God, where do you think he's at? Most human look up. What's up look like? Up looks blue.
L.
U. So, where does all righteousness and holiness come from? Up above. What color is it always? Blue. All right? Now, let's look, where does man come from? Dirt. The Hebrew for dirt is red. So when you look at man, we came from dirt, we return to dirt. What do we look? We look down. So down, red. Red equals man. Blue, of course, is God. Oops, as I drop all my toys. Blue represents God's color. Thank you, sir. Represents man's color. What's the purple job? A mixture. How do you mix those up? Why would you mix them up? There's one functionality to mix. When you mix what is truly holy in God's eyes, and you mix them with man's messiness, you get purple. The only person who represents a mix of God and man, who is that? Messiah. And is he our king? Yes. Is he our high priest? Yes. Matter of fact, he even has a crown on his head. Look, it's written right there. See right there. It says, Holy to the Lord. It's a gold crown. So what is he? Royal. It is purple. It is Messiah. Yeah. Hence you have the three main colors. You have blue, you have red, and you have purple. These are common colors used for all the symbols in your Bible when it comes to these colors. We have a fourth example, which I do not have the color of linen up here. I'm going to pretend it's orange, okay? So, linen. What was that?
It's purple,
right? Linen. Linen, I don't have a color of off-white, but anyway, linen is linen. Linen doesn't have, linen is not man, it's not God, it's not man, it's not purple. What is linen supposed to be? That is the only supposed white color that exists as far as we're concerned. It's bright. It's bright. It's the only bright color they have, the whiteness. when they say something is washed clean and made white, they're saying it's made like linen. Let your sins be as scarlet, as you make them white as snow. So what's linen supposed to be? Purity. It's pure. It's bright and pure. Make sense? So what, of course, is always obviously, this should have been better gold color. I don't have a linen color, so I'm going to reuse the orange. It's gold, too. What's gold's functionality? It's actually yellow, but that's okay. What's gold's functionality? It's not strength. What's the spiritual functionality of gold? It is pure. It belongs to God. It's pure God. It's the gold is mine. Everything's mine, right? You'll notice this temple. Well, this thing too. But the temple here, it's on the other page, right? There it is. Oop! Again, I break my toys. Thank you, sir. I know. I need to slow down some. So we have the bronze items. We have other things. We have more bronze. You start getting inside. Now you've got gold. Gold is most of the stuff in here. Actually, all the stuff in here is all gold. And, of course, lots of gold over here. Notice the difference when you're going from the outside, which is just dirt. You have your fabric, which has some gold posts and such. You have all your bronze equipment here. You start moving closer and closer to God. What are you getting? You're closer and closer to holiness. So gold be holy. So what does the priest have on him? God, man, Messiah, pureness, and holiness. That's what he presents to God every atonement. So all the sins, all the garbage that we do, he puts on the goat and says, okay, goat, go away. The goat runs off the wilderness and hopefully gets eaten. What happened to him? Who cares? It's gone. And so everybody else is only presented looking like this. And it's everybody else. All the tribes are presented to look just like this. That's what we look like as far as God's concerned on atonement. If it's not received, means we're not sincere about it. Let's pretend for a minute. We take something away. God, yeah, I look up to God. I pray to God. He's in the heavens. Yeah, I know I'm a man. And I believe Messiah, but I like my garments a little dirty. Let's erase this and make this bright to it's more brown. Do you want to present it to God? No, you don't. We don't want that presentation to God. We want it to look correct. So our inner parts that only God sees, we want them to look correct. The inside and the outside need to match. So our appearance, God looks at not just the inside of us, he looks at the outside as well. Because both work together. They work as an intermingled thing. It's a full presentation, inside and outside. So if anything's missing, if anything's messed up, we're not presented correctly to God on atonement. Our insides and our outsides need to match. That is why we have atonement. The goat makes sure our insides match. It gets rid of the stuff that doesn't match. Gets rid of the ickiness, all the sins and transgressions and iniquities. Makes them go away. Now your insides stay bright and pure and holy, and all the other things are good. Does that make sense? Any questions so far? Yes.
I think the word atonement is interesting the way it's put together. At one
man. In English, yes, it is. It is. Yes, to be at one with God.
Meaning at one.
Yes, to be at one with God. Well, you want to be this way. We want to be at one with him so he can dwell in us and us with him. That makes sense. So this is why... Oh, crap, I'm out of time already. Almost. So we had to break the sequence in Exodus. We talked about this, the oil from the lamp. And then there's all this garments he has on. Note, the high priest wears this all garments once a year. The rest of the time, what garment is he always wearing? The linen and a turban around his head. That's what he wears, and a sash. Now, by the way, a sash is sort of like a belt on the linen. So that's what he wears the rest of the time as far as what his normal functionality, his normal priestly function, that's what he wears. That's his normal outfit. It's his underclothing he always wears. All this is only shown up, dressed up this way as a full appearance one day a year. Yes?
Just wondering when the zizits fit into this.
Oh, he doesn't have zizit on in this outfit, but not in this one.
Do the people, or when does that come as far as the time frame?
The rest of the priests have them, and also the ordinary people would too. I don't have that drawing, but I will sketch one up for you. Okay? in his normal tunic, his undergarments. Crude sketch, as most of my sketches are. Okay, bad sketch, whatever. Normal tunic, undergarments. He has a sash, which we use the word sash. The undergarment would be a belt around his waist, the sash, all made from linen. This garment, the undergarment, would always have his little tzitzit on it. That's on that. Not on his outer garments. The outer garments have to look like this. This, like I said, artist interpretation how they did this. So as far as the tzitzit inside this one, it would be on this white garment, which they have drawn their own way. It would be a little bit shorter than that, because the bells are supposed to stand out more so than the garment is underneath it. And that would be that his tzitzit would be on, the four corners of his garment. They'd be on this outfit. All his sons and all the other priests would wear an outfit that looked like this. And they'd have their own little turban type of hat that would also be of the same material. All of a natural white linen. It also, of course, keeps it clean because it sort of you'd see you'd wash it. So this is their normal everyday, you know, functionality priestly garments. Does that make sense?
Yeah, just a quick question. So could their
zizits be down around their knees, or are we talking thigh area? Or
okay, as far as where it goes, there's lots of people who disagree and argue this point. So I'm not going to go into a lot of great detail. The tzitzit, it's the word tzitzit comes from the word tweet tweet, which is a bird tweeting. That's where it comes from, is a tweet 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 tweet. When you hear a bird tweet, your natural reaction is to look. Look at, where's the noise coming from? Tweet tweet tweet, oh yeah, what's that? That's the tzitzit's job, is when you see it, is to look at it or remind you, to catch your attention. That's its functionality. It could be a mile long, it could be an inch long. The point is, what is its function? Is it catching your attention or is it not? That's how it's supposed to work. If it catches your attention, it's blue. When you see blue, what do you see? God. Okay? That's what's job, to catch your attention. So whatever you're doing, every day of your week, every day of your life, every hour of your day, you have to go on a business, you look down or whatever, it's supposed to be somewhat in the way, not like, you know, obtrusive, but somewhat there. So you would see it all the time. And you would see and remind yourself, God's on me.
They're not supposed to touch the ground either.
They're not supposed to, but I've seen them touch the ground.
Yeah. Well, and with the difference is, I think a lot of us, the messianics and everything, you know, aren't necessarily as careful about that. But if you were to ask a true Orthodox Jew, they would say it is never to touch the ground.
Right.
So, you know, it's just kind of...
It can't be too
long. I know
long.
A lot of people, lot of men, especially where I'm in a katan, which
stops about the waist,
or,
roughly.
You know, yeah, right. It's an undershirt.
Those are modern day creations.
Right.
You could attach a tzitzit here, which is where I would instantly attach it, but one could argue attach the belt too. The point is, it's supposed to be there to remind you, to be the bird tweeting all the time. God's with you, God's on you, God's watching you. God's with you, God's on you, God's watching you. Again and again and again, repeat, repeat, repeat. Because we're human. And what do? Out of sight, out of mind. Oh, that looks like fun. Let's go do that. No. God's watching you, he's observing you, he's on you all the time. So everything we do, always know God's watching us. That's its reminder. So which means, and what's he watching? Well, our work, because that's what we do the oil for. Here's the oil, God. Here, look at what I'm doing. And God says, yeah, I see what you're doing. I don't like it. Fix this. Because we're human. We do that. I do that. We all do that. We have a tendency to go about our daily lives.
Sometimes
all the time, right? Sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's move on a little bit further. So that's the inner tunic. The wool, the blue wool garment, has these little the bells and pomegranates. The pomegranates are woven fabric or stitched fabric. The bells are gold. And what's the reason for the bells? To hear him. You hear him walking around and doing stuff. Yes.
All right, pomegranates have how many seeds?
No, okay, hold on. They have anywhere from 250... to, I think it was 960 seeds.
Oh, okay.
Depends from fruit to fruit to fruit to fruit to fruit. It varies from huge to very little. Now, the symbolism they use behind pomegranate is the Hebrew Jewish symbol, the 613. Because all the commandments of the Bible, you add them all up, even the ones that says, go do this, the simple ones, are 613 if you add them all up. And most of them were actually rattled off, you know, I think 3 chapters ago, like 50 of them were, 4 chapters ago. So those, that's the symbolic number. Forget the symbolic number. Let's look at the pomegranate itself. Because I happen to like plants. I love plants because they're interesting, the way God made them. It's one of my favorite topics, is plants and trees. Mind you, the symbolism, not how they're grown. I have a black thumb. I kill most things. But if I wasn't a black thumb, it'd be great. So, pomegranate. When you draw a pomegranate in Hebrew, it looks like this. As far as the Bible's concerned. Yeah, it looks like a bomb. If in the secular world, we draw pomegranates look like this. Because when you look at the top of a pomegranate, what's it look like? A six-pointed star. This is what pomegranates look like. They all look like this. This is what a pomegranate is. Hebrew, they're artistic drawing. They draw them like this, artistry-wise. The functionality of pomegranate, I wish to ask, challenge any one of you to do this. It's really, really, really hard. How many of you have opened up a pomegranate before? Yeah. Who has done it with never breaking a single seed? Now, I've seen that. I tried that, and I have not been able to do it. I've tried and tried and tried. Every time I do it, one, because just the peeling of the skin off rips my seeds apart. It breaks the seeds. Every time. So, pomegranates have a whole boatload of seeds. Hundreds of seeds. All right? Yeah, a whole bunch of them. When you try to... a whole bunch. So, if you have a whole bunch of seeds in there, and they're all red blood color, most of them, well, assuming they're ripe. The ones unripe, okay, whatever. But the ripe ones are red blood color. When you try to open them up, you're going to break seeds, right? Pomegranate is a royal fruit. All right? It is a representation of your Messiah. The fruit itself is. When you cut him open, what's going to happen? He bleeds. You cannot eat a pomegranate without opening up and making it bleed. Right? You cannot partake of Messiah without making him bleed. Get the picture? Pomegranates represent him. Always. It also represents all royalty. If you look at your Bible and discuss how Solomon used the pomegranates, it represents the royal house of Israel. All the kingly lines, the number of years they're going to reign over Israel. This is Messiah's reign. But the symbolism is that you cannot partake of him, you can't eat it, without making it bleed. Get the symbol? It represents him. So this is all around the skirt of his garment, these pomegranates. And they're in woven form, not gold form. The bells are gold. Why? Because the bells jingle and the pomegranates don't. So the bells are jingling bells. I have a question for you. We've asked this every year. I'll ask it again. Does God need the bells so he doesn't accidentally kill the high priest? Oh, I didn't know you were here. Seriously, does God not see something? What can he not see? The high priest coming in, he knows the high priest is there. He knew him before he was even born. He knew exactly what was going to happen. So why does God need bells? He accidentally killed the high priest. Oh, I was dressing and you caught me off guard. I whacked you. I'm sorry. It doesn't work that way. What's the point of God saying, put bells on him, at least I kill him? Hold on. One more at a time. Go ahead, Don. So people can hear him. There is a part of that. That's actually an important aspect. So go ahead, Rose. What was your comment here?
I was going to say so the guys outside could pull him out by a rope.
And if he dies.
If he dies.
Yes. If there's a tradition that states that when the high priest went in there, in case he screwed up, the tradition that they had a rope on his foot. Yeah. So in case he dropped dead, don't hear bells. Uh-oh. God wasn't pleased with him. He obviously didn't do something right. Let's pull his body out. Yeah. That was because they couldn't go in and get it because they would die too. Tradition. I have no idea if it's true or not. I don't know if he was ever even died. Who cares? God doesn't need the bells. He likes the pomegranate. He doesn't need the bells. So we have, so the people can hear him. What else is the functionality there? Any ideas?
Well, the people can hear him. The man is supposed to represent the Lord. I mean, he is holding us unto the Lord. And
yes.
If we hear the bells, we start to, oh, I'm just doing this other thing and it's against the law.
That's actually a good point. I think about that one. I hadn't thought about that one before.
The cows have bells.
Wait, so one at a time. What was that?
Cows have bells.
Cows have bells.
Sheep have bells.
Yep. So. Well, I think animals have to catch our attention that they're there. And they attract the, oh, where'd they go? Oh, I hear the bells are over there. They're across that hill. Yes.
To listen to the holy priest.
Ah. Let's discuss a little bit about his garments, shall we? Just as briefly, because I'm... Oh, crud. Okay, I'm way out of time. But I have too much to cover, but let's... I have Purim to do still. I'm going to erase this real quick. I'm going to break this apart a little bit simpler for all of us to see what these comments are. So, excuse me. So we have basically these few garments. We're not discussing every single one of them, but they have their symbolic function. You have the ephod. You have the breastplate. You have the, what was the other items? The robe, which is blue.
L-U-E. You can spell blue.
And you have the tunic, which is a linen. These are the basic ingredients, basic items rattled off here. There's a few others. You have the sash, and you have a turban too. So you have a sash, which we call as a belt. And you have a turban. Oh, come on. In turban. Okay. Let's break these down a little simpler for me. At least this is how I think. I could be wrong. Oops. Messed up my microphone. This is how I look at it. Breastplate. Its functionality, which we discussed in great detail earlier regarding your light and the truth that's inside of it and all stuff. And it's supposed to cover his heart. Oops. Heart's both an H. The breastplate is for his heart. It covers his heart. The ephod essentially is a skirt or like an apron or an outer covering. Which its only function is to carry the breastplate. That's really the ephod's real function, is to carry the breastplate. Everything else, it doesn't matter. If he doesn't carry this, it's worthless. That's why it says the breastplate ephod are attached to the blue cords, never to be separated. They're tied together. The robe is his outside. This is the outer cover is just for the breastplate. These breastplate and ephod are tied together as a single unit, essentially. The robe is his outer garment. And he has the tunic is the inner garment. Should write faster. And the sash, of course, is a belt. The sash and turban are tied together. Sorry, not tied, but the turban. The sash and the tunic are tied together because the sash holds the tunic on. And his turban covers his head. I should erase this better. And the turban, on the turban, its functionality is not the covering of the head. Its function is the plate that's attached to it right across his forehead. The turban has this plate. The plate, the gold plate. These are the basic components we're dealing with. We have the ephod and breastplate, does the heart. We have the blue, which is the outer garment. We have the inner garment, which of course includes the sash. We have the head, which includes the gold plate. You shall love the Lord your God with your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. Let's look at this. Heart. Check. Mind. Check. Soul. Check. Strength. Check. Because why we know the outer garment strength? It makes noise. It does something. The only garment that actually does something is the outer blue one, because it has bells on it. So what is the symbolic point of all of these garments that the high priest is wearing? You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and all your strength. This is the outfit, this is God, this is the outfit of our Messiah. This is what he looks like. Does it make sense? So what we're looking at when we look at the high priest, we're looking at how God wants you to love him. How he wants you to function. With all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, your spirit, and of course, all your strength that you do. Does that make sense? This is the symbolic we're looking at. Now we're going to leave the garment. So we have to go back to the whole point of this discussion today, which is The other garment, the other thing, the thing over there. I feel like, what's that? Princess Bride. Okay, the other thing. We have to move on to this one. Because there's a reason why God separated and divided out the oil, then the priestly garment. Now he's all perfect and clean, and perfect and wonderful in every way. Now we're going to move on to the incense, which is his function. What he's going to be doing. Okay, I'll try to cover this reasonably fast, but not too fast. I'm going to have to skip a few verses and jump around a little bit because I'm out of time to cover everything. So, in verse... chapter 30, the last few verses, the 10 verses there, there's chapter 30. You should take an altar, bring incense on it, and smoke of acacia wood, make it gold, blah, 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 here's its sizes, yada, yada, yada. You shall put incense on it what times a day? I'm going to erase this because I have other stuff to write up. How often do we put incense on it? Twice a day. When do we do it? Morning, afternoon. What are we doing when we do it? He says certain times which you will do it. So the incense... Is it S-E or E? Oh, well. Whatever. Incense, I'm pretending I spelled it right. Incense is burned twice a day. At the times which he trims the wicks, which means he snuffs the candles out, and when he lights the candles, lights them up again. Do you light candles? When do you light candles? Darkness, right? So morning, early, and then evening or afternoon, or evening, which is dusk, or as the sun is setting, or before the sun sets. These two times a day, he tied the incense to the menorah. Why on earth would God tie incense to the menorah? There are two different things. The menorah is his eyeballs. What's the incense? Prayers. How do you know it's prayers? Who told you that? Yes, the Bible says so. Incense equals prayer. When John the Baptist's dad was before God, what was he doing? Burning incense. It's done twice every day. This is his turn to do it. So in the time which he's burning incense, what were the people outside of the room doing? They were praying. So also, the point of that symbol is that the burning the incense and the prayers of people are hand in hand tied together. No, I don't know if it was evening or morning. I can't remember if he was there, if he records. But either way, it's done twice a day, every day. Every day of the week, it's always done. So it's always done twice a day. Because you have to light the menorah every single day. Even on Shabbats, it's always lit. So we always do this twice a day. God tied these together because your book of Revelation says so. Let's go there. He wanted these tied because they meant something very important to God. They have to be tied at the same time as each other. Jump to... okay, I'm not going to cover every little thing. But by the way, you can look at this part. The part of this, you can look at yourself. You have Revelations of 4 and 5 discuss the eyes and the incense regarding what the eyes mean, the angels of God, the menorah, as well as... the incense as far as the prayers of the people, of the 12, 24 elders, their prayers. So let's jump to Revelation chapter 15. Revelation 15. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is complete. I saw something like the sea of glass filled with fire, and those who had the victory of the beast over his image, over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing in the sea of glass, having lamp harps to God. They sang the song of Moses over God, the song of the Lamb. I'm going to skip down a little bit. Verse 5. As these things I looked and behold, the temple of tabernacle, the testimony of heaven, testimony in heaven was opened. Out of the temple came the seven angels having the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen, having their chests girded with golden bands. Stop. Hold it. We've seen this before. I'm going to erase this. This is how I break things sometimes. The seven lampstands. Let's zoom in and make a blow-up picture with the little lamps on top of the menorah look like. I'm zooming in very closely. So you have a bowl. Okay, I should have erased better than that. I'm drawing on top of my old drawings. That's confusing. You have seven bowls. What's in the bowls?
Oil.
So they're all carrying bowls. Each lamp has a bowl. Each angel is carrying a bowl here in Revelations. What are these angels doing? They're holding the bowls. What's in the bowls? Oil. What's it says here in Revelations? It's the wrath of God. The plagues of God are sitting. These angels are carrying them. So you have the menorah. They're all in the temple. There's seven of them. And they have bands around their waists. When you look at this, when you look at the description given for them, when you look at it, it says that there are, is it the way these bowls are made, they're made to look like almonds and almond blossoms. So you have little petals of the almond blossom on the outside. They look like little wings, actually. Kind of funny. Probably not coincidental. So these almond blossoms have a front and have a back. They have bands or hanging out on the, we call them knobs, or the Bible says it's knobs. They're little metal bands, gold bands around the waists. If you see a person carrying a bowl, here are my arms, about mid-waist, so what's beneath my arms? I have metal bands where my feet are. They're called a belt. I have a bowl in my hands, I have a belt on. What do I look like? I look like a man carrying a bowl. What do these things look like? An eyeball, because they're almond blossoms, which is the angel of God, carrying a bowl full of oil. What's the symbol then? How are these angels of God observing and watching and looking? They're reporting what they received, the oil from God, or from the people. It's all oil. But it's a bowl of oil. The bowl of wrath. What's God's objective for watching us? To see our works. And what if our works are lacking? You receive the wrath of God. So this symbol, this little angel, which is the eyes of God, has little, you know, looks like almost like wings, it's little almond blossoms, what they look like, and they have a front and a back. And little bands around their waists. That's what the description is. So the physical item here in the menorah is being described Revelations here with these angels. Now let's read further. Having on the chest, verse 7. Then one of the four living creatures gave the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever and ever. The temple is filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues and the seven angels were completed. Let's look at that a little closely. What is this? Oh, we'll show my printer. That's cool. What does this thing produce? This little altar? Smoke. Lots and lots and lots of smoke. It's big. When it produces smoke, they sometimes bring smoke inside, and sometimes they don't. It depends on what the application is. This whole area fills with smoke from the incense. So God is pointing out in Revelations, he is tying chapter 15 and 16 to the event of these seven angels' menorah's action. They're carrying their bowls ready to pour them out on what God has seen. And he's tying them to the incense altar of prayers of the people. So God is tying his symbols here in his temple to the events in Revelations discussed in chapter 15 and 16. He's using these symbols as a carryover. He's using the angels represented here and reading them, actually using them in the book of Revelations, in this storyline. So that's their job. Are the angels producing good reports or bad reports? Bad. That's where they get the bowls of wrath and say, go pour them out. And hear what you get. So when God's looking, and it says, when we discussed this, when it was written before, or the previous couple chapters, because this particular menorah is facing a particular direction. It's always looking at this table, showbread table. That's where they're looking at. The showbread table contains 12 loaves of bread, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. So these angels are always looking with the oil from people at the loaves of bread, which also represents them. And when they have judgment, what happens? The bowls of wrath comes out. You will read shortly when Nadab and Abihu get whacked by God, Aaron's two sons, wrath of God. And how did they get killed? So the fire from the Lord came out and burned them up. Because what is the fire? Here's fire. Look, it's up here too. What's fire doing? Always looking. Always watching. Always observing. Does that make sense? I'm out of time, like, a long time ago. So I won't have time for anything else. I didn't get all your questions answered. I apologize. One was about the Spirit. The Spirit you're referring to here earlier was had to do with the Spirit of creation, of your creating creative spirit. That's what we're referring to here in the Torah. The ones who could design the fabric. Any questions? I have Purim. We have a Purim play to do. We haven't even gotten there yet. It's about the whole book of Esther. Yes, go ahead. Any questions?
So I get the whole thing with the menorah and the bowls and the wrath and the work and the oil and whatnot, and I get the prayers of the saints. I don't get the connection from the smoke of the prayers of the saints in relation to the bowls of wrath. I didn't get that.
Yes, that is talked about in Ezekiel. Oh, what chapter is it? Crud. I forgot the chapter. Anyway, Ezekiel, there's like one or two chapters he talks about. He sees this man whose job is to go mark the people with a pen. Yeah. He marks the people, those who sigh and weep and pray, those who are saddened about the estate of affairs of the world and about their country. He marks all of this, says, okay, these are the good ones. Then all the other angels come by and says, okay, go whack the ones I didn't mark. And kills them all. Whack, 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 whack. Lots of blood, lots of guts, glory, whatever. So you have the ones who are marked good and the ones who weren't marked good. How do you get marked? Ah. Yes. And what's the functionality of the incense every day? Incense represents prayer in Revelations 5. It discusses that. Represents prayer. So every time you put incense up, it is a representation of you're praying to God. So when the menorah is being kindled, or either trimmed, the wick's being trimmed, or being lit up again for the evening time, the whole room gets filled with smoke because they start the incense at that time. So it's all filled with a really pleasant smell. I don't know what the smell smells like, but it's a nice smell. That's how it's supposed to fill up. So the prayers get filled up because when you are presenting yourself to God, when you do it, what do? I pray. So God's tying prayers, the incense, to what he's looking at the same time as the showbread, which is also represents what you are, and from the oil of what you made. It's all about you being watched. He's tying your prayers to it. When we want God to look at us, most often we're praying when we want him to do it, right? How often do you want him to look at you and you're not praying? And you're not doing anything about him? Usually we don't. Don't look at me now. But when I'm praying, look at me now. Because I want you to hear me. I want you to hear the prayers I'm saying. Look at me now. We want that. So God tied these things together on purpose. You want me to see you? Pray to me. I'll see you. You don't want me to see you? Don't pray to me. Go away. I'll just pour my wrath on you instead. That's later. That's why they're tied together. How and what the purpose behind it. The prayers have to go with the seeing. They're tied. You don't want God to look at you when you're not praying. You're looking when you are praying. That's when you're in your mind, your state, your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. You're all combined together to say one thing to present to him. Make sense?
Yes.
It's all based on symbolism. So your earlier question earlier today, when you had talked about the priests and being priests, it's a state of being. It's not so much the individual components, it's a whole state of being. It's a state which, no offense to any of you, I can't be all the time. I'm human. I need somebody else to do it for me because I'm just not that good. And I never will be. But to be a priest, I still have to be a servant. So do you. We all be servants. We still serve, we still do our work and do the best we can, but we never get that role, the high priest's role, which presents all this stuff to him all the time, even for you and myself. Does it make sense? Any other questions? Yes, Carmel.
I
Go ahead.
I think you answered, unbeknownst to you, a question that many people are struggling with, is that is the Star of David. I never recognized that the top of a pomegranate was the Star of David.
That's what it is, yeah.
So, I think you just answered that quandary. And I don't know, I've never heard that argument made for, yes, it's, you know, they're saying it's a hectagonal
pagan,
blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It came from that. Well, no, it's in God's creation.
Right.
Now, people use it and they can do other things with it, but that is a part of God's creation.
He made
it. So it is not pagan. Yeah. The origins of it are not pagan.
No, it's the top of pomegranate. If those of you who have pomegranates, I'm trying to have good ones this year. All of mine never ripen. But I'm holding good pomegranates, always the top. It's a nice, it's a very, very symmetrical six-pointed star. Larry, your question?
It's Messiah.
Yeah, it's him. Yeah. It's him. It all points straight to him. That's who it is. That's all designed to be around him. Everything is designed to be around him. Supposed to get our attention, so we learn from it and do something about it. No, it's not the cross, it's a pomegranate. Pomegranate represents what he is. Yes, and they still do, if you look at, well, still, that's not fair. They did at Messiah's time, the art at the time, which Messiah was a lot, well, okay, like 50 AD, so he died already, but he was close to it. Their artistic designs they have in Israel, they're all pomegranate designs. Now, they draw them as pomegranates side view, not top view. But they're still all pomegranates. The top view is a star, the side view is a three-point thing. It has to do with just artistic design, how you want to draw it. But it represents him. Pomegranates are the biggest thing, fruit-wise, that God made. That's the closest item that represents Messiah, because it's complete. It's royal, you've got to cut it open, it's going to bleed if you want any of it. You want to be nourished by it, it's going to bleed. And it all points directly to him. Which is also one of the reasons why Judaism has tried to. That's not fair. While some sects of rabbinical teachers have chosen to suppress the pomegranate nature of the Star of David in that way. But that's a big rat's nest of paganism thrown in there too. So it's the pomegranate and the Star of David, the combined together, is a really funky, weird, icky thing that I try to avoid. Because there's more dirt in there than there is cleanness in there, because it's been used so many different ways. It's just like our seven-candle menorah. We think of it, well, it's Jewish, right? Well, yeah, a lot of pagan societies used it too. It wasn't just Judaism that used it. But we still use it, because we know God said, this is what I want you to do. Much like our own actions are that way. So all the items God used, at some point or another, somebody paganized it and had a good time doing it. Had lots of fun till they died. So they're dead. But the ones who didn't paganize it are still alive. Go figure. So every symbol you have in the temple, in the Torah, anything, has been paganized at one time or another by somebody and have intermingled ickiness and gross and bad story, bad history with it. That's the nature of human beings, because we're human. We do that. It's like the rainbow, which was a God-given design to do one thing, and we used it totally other way. Yes.
So you had said that these cups or bowls,
yes,
okay, were filled with oil. The oil represents the plagues of God.
Well, it represents two things. Oil by itself doesn't. Oil, the olive oil by itself is the works of the people, right? That's their pressed olive oil. What they do, here God, look at me. However, when God's looking at you, does he like it or does he not? If you give me garbage oil, what am I going to do with it? I'm going to dump it out. Dump. Make sense? That just became my wrath. I hate this, I'm throwing it at you. Take it back. So I took your works, it was supposed to be pure and pressed and clean. It's not. I'm now dumping it out on the ground or on you, getting rid of it, because it's empty. It's icky stuff. I'll get cleaner stuff later. That's the symbol behind the bowl being dumped. So it was supposed to be clean. It wasn't. They dumped it. Anything else? Any questions, comments? Okay. It'll take me like 10 minutes to get, maybe 15, if I'm optimistic, 15, to get Purim set up. So we're going to call it quits, we'll close the prayer, and we'll go into Purim, and then after we'll do our Kiddush ceremony, okay? Almighty God, thank you for the Shabbat. Thank you for our time to be with one another, to learn your ways and to learn what is true and right and try our best to follow where you lead us. Father, please grant us peace and grant us a pleasant time as we worship and remember you, and also remember the story of Purim, what you did so long ago to save all of your people. We ask your blessing on this day, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.